Radio EcoShock.
Of the five great extinctions many people know, a meteor crashed into Earth, killing the dinosaurs. The other four were caused by global warming, a fact that hasn't penetrated the minds of the public or our legislators. Dr. Peter Ward is an expert on past climate and mass extinctions. He's an author, a researcher, paleontologist, and professor of biology and of earth and space sciences at the University of Washington. Among his 14 books, we find recently, Under a Green Sky, Global Warming, The Mass Extinctions of the Past and What They Can Tell Us About Our Future, The Medea Hypothesis, Is Life on Earth Ultimately Self-Destructive, and The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps. Peter Ward, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you for having me.
Why don't we start with this? How do we know four past mass extinction events were caused by global warming and not something else like a meteor impact?
Well, we certainly have some very interesting geological evidence telling us about what carbon dioxide levels were in the past. We also have great fossil evidence. When the Earth is warmed, we get very different types of plants and animals. Obviously, now we find a very different set of animals and plants at the tropics than we do at the poles. So we see that there's a tremendous correlation between times of high carbon dioxide as well as high numbers of animals and plants. And then we have a further moment in Earth's history when it's not just high carbon dioxide, but it suddenly spurts upward to extremely high levels. And at that same time, the fossil record, it shows coincident mass extinctions. The correlation between very short-term high warming and mass extinction has now been confirmed over and over and over and over to the point that it is a hypothesis that can now be elevated to a theory.
Well, can you run us through the process from excess carbon dioxide to a warmer world and then the killer gas that you've talked about?
It turns out that as the world warms, the tropics are about as hot as they can get. They can only warm up a little bit more because of a series of laws of physics, which I can't explain, but is pretty clear. The tropics aren't going to go up 20 degrees Fahrenheit, let's say. But we know that the Arctic can and does and is. And we know, for instance, that we've got far more relative warming in the number of degrees of temperature that an area is heating in the high latitudes than the low or even the mid latitudes to some extent. This is why all the Arctic ice is melting. This is why almost every article you read about global warming is dealing with the Arctic, the Antarctic. But you're not hearing things about, oh, gee, the tropics went up by 20 degrees. It doesn't happen. So when we have a really warming set of poles and a tropics which stays the same, the heat differential, the difference in temperature between the tropical regions and the Arctic regions reduces. That heat differential is what causes there to be weather, what causes there to be the redistribution of heat, which produces air currents and, most importantly, water currents. As the poles warm and the tropics don't, the world gets uniform in temperature, and with the uniform temperature, down go currents, down goes the wind, and what we start getting is stagnation. Just like you have a pond which, sitting in the warm without any sort of wind, will very rapidly turn stagnant, so too do the world's oceans become stagnant. And if they do, they lose their oxygen, just as a pond does. And a pond that is filled with rotting vegetation very quickly starts producing bubbles of gas. You can smell something. We call it swamp gas. It is a series of rotting vegetation, rotting animals, rotting organisms that are being decayed. And we find a whole new set of bacteria generally use up all of the oxygen within that pond. And then a different set of bacteria take over, which produce the very toxic gas called hydrogen sulfide. So much of what we call swamp gas, sometimes methane, but quite often this rotting egg smell is hydrogen sulfide. So let's pretend that the world is just like one giant pond where the whole thing has gone stagnant. The same principles apply, but on a global scale.
This hypothesis that hydrogen sulfide likely killed off land animals, especially mammals, how did that idea develop? Who did originate that?
There's some really interesting work about hydrogen sulfide taking place all over the planet right now in many scientific laboratories. more and more we're finding that this is an amazing gas for better and for worse. We've been studying it for a long time, the worst sides of it. Those who are dealing with groundwater, those who are drilling wells, quite often can encounter pockets of hydrogen sulfide, and it can kill the weller. So what we're looking more and more now are companies that are using meters to try to recognize when they're finding pockets of hydrogen sulfide. Well, just knowing that that gas had such a deleterious effect and is so poisonous led many researchers to begin looking at it. And like many things in high quantity, which are poisonous, in fact, in very small quantities, there's a beneficial side to it. This is how many of our really excellent medical chemicals were discovered. For instance, the terrible poison used by the old South American Indians called curare, where they would put it on their arrows. That is now in small quantities called Coumadin. This is one of the most widely prescribed medicines in the world. It's a blood thinner. After operations, you're routinely given this stuff. Hydrogen sulfide in low dose is a very beneficial aspect. And so research into it, much of it taking place at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Institute in Seattle by a guy named Mark Roth. Mark started looking at hydrogen sulfide as a way of putting mammals into suspended animation, but he found at the same time that mammals are much more susceptible to hydrogen sulfide than our reptiles. And furthermore, he discovers that warm-blooded creatures such as we really are susceptible to this stuff, whereas reptiles, any cold-bloods, cold-blooded invertebrates, have a much higher tolerance because hydrogen sulfide works on our metabolism in such a way that it essentially knocks out our ability to remain endothermic or warm-blooded. The mass extinctions in the past, the land animals, the biggest of all, the Permian extinction, shows just this pattern. Those animals which were cold-blooded, the reptiles, survived virtually untouched, where the earliest mammals, called mammal-like reptiles, still were warm-blooded. These are the creatures that died out in droves. So we had this selective extinction, and it really looks like that hydrogen sulfide did it.
Well, someone asked me about the sea life that produces hydrogen sulfide, and I couldn't explain it properly. What species does this?
There are lots and lots of bacteria that do it. The bacteria that produce this are, just as we use oxygen to respire, many other types of bacteria use sulfur, and they essentially breathe in sulfur, change it chemically, and exhale hydrogen sulfide. It's just as we exhale carbon dioxide, many bacteria exhale hydrogen sulfide. It's a waste product to get rid of it. And just as too much carbon dioxide will kill us, a lot of hydrogen sulfide can affect many kinds of bacteria. So you have to have very special conditions to have these microbes, which are sulfur breathers, and there has to be absolutely no oxygen around. They can only live on seawater or in ponds that all oxygen, all free oxygen has been used up or has otherwise disappeared. So this is where the conditions have to be such that you can produce all over the ocean bottoms a lack of oxygen. And once that happens, these bacteria, which really are everywhere around us, you simply need to go to any beach and dig down about 2 or 3 or 4 inches in some cases. You find a black layer, pick it up, smell it, and you just get this awful rotten egg smell. It's the hydrogen sulfide producing bacteria that even 3 or 4 inches beneath our nice oxygenated beaches are sitting there. So you don't have to go very far down into the earth, essentially, to find these bacteria. And if the oceans become zero oxygen all over, they just take over in huge numbers, and great quantities of hydrogen sulfide are produced.
I've just interviewed the marine biologist from the UK, Alex Rogers, about the State of the Oceans 2013 report, and he says the oceans are already losing oxygen, especially in parts of the North Atlantic and most of the tropics. Are we headed into green sky conditions?
Oh, absolutely. Just all we need to do is just keep pumping CO2 into the atmosphere, and there we go. The great Lee Kump of Penn State was, even several years ago, was looking at the model suggesting how quickly will this take place. And the Pacific Ocean, for the first time, is now viewed as losing its deep water oxygen. It takes a long time. It's not going to happen in our lifetimes, probably not in the next few generations, but if we keep producing the amount of carbon dioxide that we do, causing this differential in the temperature of the high latitudes, Arctic and the tropics, to keep reducing, and that's what we're doing, the Arctic is getting warmer every year, the tropics aren't, we reduce the amount of oxygen which makes it to the sea bottom, and you start this process, and we have started this process.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith talking with Dr. Peter Ward. Peter, I've seen science-based videos which explain frozen methane under the sea, the clath rates, were released by warming oceans to cause extreme climate change. I'm surprised you didn't mention these at all. Why not?
The clath rates, actually, it's a fascinating subject. What we don't know is exactly how much quantity of clath rates is there. Are these unto themselves sufficient to have produced the warming that you need? What's going on with clath rates, of course, is you get a positive feedback. The clath rates stay frozen in place until you warm them. And the higher latitude you go, the colder it is, the more the clath rates are stable. Well, if we say melt clath rates at a 60 degree latitude and it warms up a little bit, well, then we can perhaps the next year melt the clath rates, which are a little bit further north and on. So this is what we call a positive feedback. The warmer it gets, the warmer it gets. But the clath rates themselves probably are not sufficient. Even if we got all the clath rates out of the various systems to lead to the catastrophes that we've seen in the past, there has to be some other external force. And in the past, each time it has been a major volcanic event that we call flood basalts. And the flood basalts, believe me, they cause the warming, and then the clath rates can add in. But I don't think the clath rates alone are part of it. And so, again, what we can say is that the extraordinary volcanic activity this time aren't volcanoes, but it is human industry.
Well, I want to talk to you about that because, you know, I have a science alert service. And last July, there was an announcement that British scientists have studied James Lovelock's Gaia theory, that life more or less purposefully changes the Earth to suit its own survival. And they found science could not back that up. But you already did that work several years previously in your book, The Medea Hypothesis. Briefly, who was Medea and what is that hypothesis?
Medea was Jason's wife. If we're going to use Gaia, which is the Greek for good mother, I just took my tongue firmly in cheek and say, well, let's use what the bad mother is. And in Jason and the Golden Fleece myth, Jason went off to go after this Don Quixote-like task of finding the Golden Fleece. And to do that, he fell in love, or he got the daughter of the king who owned the fleece to fall in love with him. Jason turned out to be a very bad husband, and in very great distress, his wife murders their children, making her, at least in Greek mythology, the worst mother of all time. Too much life is the cause of many of the mass extinctions. We're just talking about the formation of hydrogen sulfide, that it takes bacteria to do it. This is life producing a gas which led at least 4 to 5 times to the destruction of over half of all species. That's not very Gaian, if you ask me.
But you've said that these mass extinctions were really triggered by a geological event, namely the eruption of mass amounts of lava from volcanoes. Surely we can't attribute that to a suicidal urge in living things.
No, but certainly what did cause the poison itself was being produced by the bacteria. I mean, you could have all the volcanic stuff in the world, but it took the addition of these hydrogen sulfide producing microbes to actually bring the actual kill mechanism. This is what the missing element was for so long. Things get warmer, things get colder, but how could such mass death take place? I mean, that was where, gosh, there's something really, really missing about this. I mean, you might say that, gee, uranium sits around. It doesn't do anything to anybody. How could we say that uranium is involved in an atomic weaponry? Well, it took the humans to put the uranium into its little state of explosiveness. And so in the same sort of way, the warming simply opens up the world for the microbes to do the coup de grace.
Well, moving forward in your books, you say rising seas are the single greatest problem of climate change. I had inner objections when I heard that. What about the impacts of violent storms and the loss of agricultural production with heating? Why are rising seas number one?
Well, I think rising seas themselves are going to affect agriculture in such a negative way. Yes, you're going to have the effects on agriculture from other aspects, but the rising seas themselves, I think, are the shortest term, most dangerous process that will affect, I think, global politics. You only have to raise the oceans by, say, 2 meters to have an enormously deleterious effect on even just rice alone. Much of rice is farmed at very low elevations, as we know. It's right next to the ocean in most cases. And the single most productive agricultural sites on Earth are deltas. I mean, the great Asian deltas, the Ganges, the Brahmaputra, the Mekong, each of these enormous low areas where rice is grown in enormous quantities. We look at the delta that takes place around the India subcontinent. Bangladesh, for instance, feeds itself. It has an enormous population, but feeds itself because of four crops per year. We often have two, but they have four. And yet, if we have a 6-foot sea level rise, about 50% of Bangladesh food production disappears. It's not that it just gets covered with seawater, but saltwater goes sideways, and you don't have to have the sea actually covering a field to ruin the field. When you look forward at what might be the agricultural production with a 6-foot sea level rise, and until recently the IPCC was saying that we could expect to have a 4-foot sea level rise by 2100. People are bandying that around. But if it doesn't happen by 2100, certainly by 2150, you're going to have a 6-foot sea level rise. What happens to those fields, and how do we replace those fields and all the people that they feed? This is going to be a really rapid change when we have a burgeoning human population. So this is where I think geopolitically it's going to affect the poorest nations on Earth at the highest level and with the greatest disaster.
In your Edmonds College talk last April, you made some extreme statements. For example, you said, don't spend money on Galveston, Texas, and just plain, quote, get out of South Florida. You're going to upset some people there. Why say that?
Well, if you take the long view, Galveston, Texas, South Florida, many of these areas are going to be inundated. Look at what New Jersey is doing. We get the global warming spawn storm, Hurricane Sandy, last year. It wipes out, it knocks down all of the New Jersey amusement parks, the waterfront, such. They just rebuild it right back up in the same place. How many times do you have to have this stuff knocked down before you realize, gee, maybe we shouldn't be putting that money back into it? The areas that really, I think, are going to really affect us most strongly, most of the world's airports, in many respects, are at sea level. You find airports everywhere along the coasts of the continents. Countries that can build airports out into the ocean. San Francisco did this. Japan does this. China did it. Honolulu. It's just a number of airports I've landed in Sydney where you're just skimming the ocean and then you're on this tarmac. All of those are going to get covered over by even the 3 to 5 foot sea level rise because of storm surge. You have to rebuild them. It's the amount of money we're going to have to do to just to move stuff inland, and we'll keep doing it over and over and over. So this, to me, is the economic problem that's facing us from sea level rise.
Well, I agree with you, but, you know, Professor Emeritus Guy McPherson concludes that maybe humans will become extinct before the year 2100 due to climate change, and yet you're talking about rebuilding airports away from the sea. Why do you assume we will survive and continue as a civilization, even if we get a 4 to 8 degree C heating event, if that's possible?
I don't see how anyone could say we'll be extinct by 2100. We have the technology. We're so capable of saving ourselves. Happy, maybe not, but safe, yes. It's always been my sense that, in fact, humans might be the most extinction-proof of all species because of our technical ability, because of ultimately we can build a gas mask, which almost nothing else can do. No, we're going to be here, but we're going to be here in increasingly isolated company compared to wildlife that's around us and the biodiversity. But no, I think we're going to muddle through just fine.
This is Radio EcoShock with Dr. Peter Ward as our guest. Peter, we all know climate denial flourishes in Congress and in the public mind. You blamed high school teaching and especially the university system. Please tell us about that.
The culture at the university is that what you want in a young faculty member, a young scientist that is in a science faculty, is to publish great scientific papers. Research is number one. Number two can be teaching. Number three, service to the university. And number four, outreach to the public. It is really in that order. Anybody who thinks otherwise, really, you need to know this is the truth. The better the university, the less interest there is in what we call outreach. And in outreach, I'm talking about communication, science communication, that which leads to science literacy. The great scientific universities are aiding and abetting science illiteracy by making no call, no requirement of their young faculty moving up to change, to do something about this, to not write a paper for Science or Nature and instead do one for Scientific American. Go on a TV show, put as much effort into that scientific study and try to make it into a science for the public study. So there is no push for this because the universities need government money. They need the big science grants, and science grants go for published articles. They don't go for articles for the public. This is this enormous disconnect. It's what the public believes and what the science universities believe. And once you have a culture where your young people don't have to do it, they rise through time, and then they're the powers. Well, we didn't have to do it, so we're going to just keep this going. It's self-perpetuating. It's a travesty.
When we talk about solutions, you have a low opinion about physicist Paul Crutzen's proposal to spray sulfur aerosols from airplanes to cool off the planet. How do you know the resulting acid rain would kill off lots of life on Earth?
Well, one never knows. I mean, this is a case, maybe he's totally correct. But certainly all we have to do is look at what happened to Canada in the 1960s and 1970s with the American power plants and all the coal-fired power plants in the American Midwest and much of that pollution moving up into the beautiful Ontario lakes. There's clearly a very bad side effect of having sulfur particles coming out of these power plants, landing in the fresh water and creating increased acidity. I mean, it is a very anti-life type of chemical work. So Crutzen is just saying the same thing, is that we're going to put the same types of particles that come out of these coal-fired plants, except we'll put them all over in the atmospheres. How could there not be resulting acid rain coming from this? He's won the Nobel Prize. I haven't. He must be right. But common sense suggests he's not.
Practically, the only optimism I've heard from you lately is that we may not have to lose all the ice caps totally. Why not?
Well, there's a lot of interesting information coming out now that more and more it may be that in the Cretaceous, even 65 million years ago, in the Cretaceous at the time when the dinosaurs died out, the very end of it, there may have been some ice sheets. There may have been ice on the planet when carbon dioxide reached about 1,000 parts per million. This is a very hotly debated subject right now. It's intensively being researched. The answer isn't there yet, but it gives me hope. If we can find out that we could have 1,000 parts per million, for instance, we're at 400 now. If we could have 1,000 parts per million and still have some ice, the fact that at 1,000, maybe all the ice doesn't melt, this certainly is going to ameliorate the catastrophe that I see by causing, say, 240 feet of sea level rise all over the planet when you lose all the ice. So maybe the catastrophe won't be quite as bad as we thought. But who's to say it's going to stop at 1,000 parts per million? If we keep industrialized civilization going, we could easily push it up to 2,000 parts per million, and then we really clearly are not going to have any ice at all.
Do you have a new book or research project you're working on that you'd like to tell us about?
Yeah, I have a book coming out in April. It's called A New History of Life. I tried to take, with my colleague Joe Kirschfink at Caltech, we tried to put together all the new crackpot ideas about how life started on this planet, about its early evolution, about some of the aspects of atmosphere. It's really a book about atmosphere, asking, as oxygen levels go up and down, as carbon dioxide levels go up and down, what can it tell us about how the evolution of plants and animals on this planet changed? So it's pretty long, 135,000 words, and we're right now fighting over the editing, but that's the project that will be out next.
We've been talking with Dr. Peter Ward, a paleontologist at the University of Washington and author of more than a dozen books. Find links to his work and our previous Radio EcoShock interviews in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Peter, as always, I want to thank you not just for your time now, but for your outspoken bravery always. We need it.
Well, thank you, but more than we need people like me, we need people like you, because you are the conscience of this planet, and there's people like you that actually give me the hope to keep going. So I want to thank you, Alex.
You're making me blush. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.